This is The Money on RN, online, on your podcasting app of choice. I'm Richard Ady, and today you're hearing about counterfeit goods, which overwhelmingly come from China. Tim Roxburgh's with me. Tim, you've been looking at this.
Yeah, Richard, one recent case that really caught my attention was about fake car parts.
What kind of fake are we talking about?
So this particular case involved parts with the brand name of the car's original manufacturer. So they're made to look genuine, but they're fake. And this case ended in a huge bust of a counterfeit facility in China. Authorities there found tens of thousands of these fake car parts. But this case all started with an auto worker somewhere in Australia taking a closer look at a car part.
Someone who worked in the industry actually discovered the part coming through and thought this part that was in a genuine box had the barcode and the serial number from Toyota, looked at the part and for whatever reason thought it just didn't feel or seem like it was the real part.
It was pretty lucky, really, that this auto worker noticed something amiss, because I've seen pictures of this part, and if you weren't already suspicious, it would easily pass for the real thing. This is Tony Weber. He's the chief executive of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries.
Some of the parts are extraordinarily high quality, and to the eye, it's very difficult for a consumer to know, and even the engineers in the company sometimes find it difficult to determine from just a quick look at them which one's the genuine and which one's the non-genuine.
So Toyota got this part sent over to their workshop to take a closer look. And when they pulled it apart, their hearts must have sunk. What they were looking at was a potential tragedy in the making. Because this obscure part they had in their hands has a very important job. Tony Weber tells me it's called a clock spring. What the hell is a clock spring?
A clock spring is the part that sits in the, behind the steering wheel and before the steering column. And what it does is it makes sure there's an electrical connection as you turn the steering wheel at all points in time. So in modern cars, you've got a lot of functions that come off the steering wheel. Typically, you have the radio, you have the horn, you have the cruise control, and more importantly, you have the airbag that protects the driver. So you want to have an electrical connection at all points in time as you turn the steering wheel. There's gold plating that actually makes the connectivity between the electric signal. And when they tore down these parts, they didn't have the gold plating. So that, and if you don't have that connection and you're in an accident, the problem might be that the airbag won't deploy.
So at this point, Toyota realises they have a serious situation on their hands. There are who knows how many people driving around with these dodgy clock springs in their steering wheels, thinking they have a genuine, safe Toyota part.
Obviously, at this point in time, they're extremely concerned about the outcome and they're concerned about their consumers who are doing the right thing, buying what they believe to be genuine parts and now have potentially their lives at risk.
When I heard about what Toyota's next move was, I have to say, it surprised the hell out of me until I realised that it was perfectly logical. The next thing they did was hire a PI.
Private investigators are quite often used by the companies when they get a heads up through their counterfeit hotlines, and they will go and investigate the issue, go and try and source the product, and then take it through their engineers. And we also need to link back to the consumers that have these parts in the car, because ultimately my members are very concerned about the welfare of the consumer driving the vehicle that they've sold.
So given that, you'd think once the PIs had snuck around and worked out who was selling these parts, they'd dob them in to the authorities and then hope for the best. But Toyota had a better idea. Instead, they took the sellers of this part to court.
For Toyota in this case, there were three real priorities in actually going down the path of the federal court. One was to make sure that these counterfeit parts were taken off the market. Second was to ensure that the customers were notified that the part they had was not genuine. And the third element is to find the ultimate source of the counterfeit part and have that removed from the market and destroyed.
So at this point, Toyota still needs something from the people they've caught red-handed selling these fake parts. They need information. They want to know where the scammers got the parts. They want to know who they sold them to. So how do you get information out of a scammer? Well, it seems instead of calling in the authorities, you negotiate.
It was settled out of court. So there was some level of compliance, obviously, in the process. They actually obviously came to the table, and those three fundamental issues I was talking about were all addressed.
A pretty good outcome. And as far as Toyota knows, no one was involved in any accident or injury because of these parts. But there's one catch. Part of the deal was that the identity of the people selling these things remains secret. So I can only presume they're still out there, still selling parts, hopefully safe ones. But Toyota told me that what they did get out of this deal was crucial information about where the parts came from. One guess as to where the factory was. That's right, China. And in China, they found the motherlode.
There were over 33,000 fake parts in the facility that had a street value of over $1 million. There was filters and cables for safety, critical items, brake master cylinders and brake pads.
Of course, China has a reputation for being the origin of so many fakes. Not just car parts, stuff of all kinds.
The scale is vast, and virtually everything that you can imagine has been copied or probably will be copied.
This is Cal Raustiala. He's a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles Law School.
You can find entire neighborhoods from European cities, copied iconic buildings, knockoff industries like handbags and clothing and sunglasses and anything that has a logo or label.
So why has China become such a cornucopia of the counterfeit? Cal Raustiala says one reason China's government is often reluctant to crack down on this stuff is it helps them deal with the country's severe inequality.
In a society like that, the ability to copy freely and take what is often an expensive product, like let's say the iPhone, and create, there is something called the HiPhone there, create a very cheap knockoff version, that's really a valuable social result.
Of course, this kind of thing causes all sorts of outrage in countries like the US, where these products are often invented. But here's the thing, Cal Raustiala is not outraged. He says before we judge China too harshly for this kind of copying culture, we should take a look at the history of countries like the US.
So in the United States, we make a big deal out of IP, out of intellectual property protection around the world. And that's because we are a cultural producer of the first order. I mean, we're the home of Hollywood, produce a lot of books, as well as pharmaceuticals and patents and so forth. So we make a big deal out of it. But our history shows a slightly different story. So if you look at 19th century America, for example, we were the China of the day.
Turns out in the 19th century, it was the U.S., that was casually knocking things off and then just flipping the bird at foreign creators and inventors.
The British, who were the primary, the primary producer, for example, of books, those books were sent over to the United States and copied frequently illegally, and British publishers were livid about it. And the United States didn't really care. That was just the way things were done for a long time. And it really was only in the 20th century that we began to change our intellectual property laws to focus on not only domestic producers, but also foreign producers, foreign creators.
So copying, creating knockoffs, might be an important stepping stone in economic development. And on top of that, Cal Raustiala says that anyway, copying can be good for innovation.
To have a really vibrant, innovative economy, you need to have access to inputs. So in other words, we don't simply create things out of the blue. We build on things that came before. And the ability to do that requires that we have some access to existing things. And that requires some tolerance of copying.
So if I'm sitting here in Australia and I'm going to come up with something, a movie or a new invention, it's hard work to turn that kind of dream into a reality, right? So why would I go to the effort of doing that if I know that someone in China is just going to turn around and copy it on an industrial scale almost the moment that thing hits the market?
No, that's absolutely right. And so that's exactly why we have patent laws and copyright laws and so forth. Now, the important question is whether we really need to have those laws to stop copying, and of course, whether those laws are even effective against copying. And some aspects of the Chinese economy might be like that. We can't really change those things. But I think on the other hand, there's reason to expect China to evolve in its views. And there's also some positive examples. So some positive effects of copying.
Case in point, that sandwich shop, Subway. They opened stores in China, and pretty quickly they found that the whole store was being copied.
For Subway, though, trying to sell something that's not a traditional Chinese food, it's a sandwich shop, they took a more kind of relaxed view and said, okay, maybe it's not so bad that we're being knocked off because this is creating market share for us. Eventually, Chinese people are going to get richer. They're going to want the real thing.
This fakes as marketing tactic isn't just something that works on Chinese consumers. It probably works on you too.
So there have been studies, very interesting study out of Harvard Business School that looked at handbags and women who would have these purse parties. And in the purse parties, they would get together at somebody's house and they would have knockoff handbags and they would be sold. And months later, something like 30 to 40% of the women would then buy the real handbag. And so they would treat the knockoff as a kind of trial. And then once they were happy with it, they'd buy the real one.
Of course, Carl Raustiala recognises that not all knockoffs are harmless like this, especially when it comes to safety-critical car parts and pharmaceuticals. But the kind of crackdown that companies like Toyota want to see against fakes in China may already be in the wings.
They can be the workshop for the world, as they've been for a long time, but as they develop more mature firms in which the brand becomes really critical, well, then they'll want to protect those brands. And I think that's probably inevitable that there'll be some of that in years to come, certainly in decades to come.
And there's a sign of that change in the case of the counterfeit clock springs we heard about earlier. Because in that case, the Chinese authorities did something that they've been reluctant to do sometimes in the past. They came down on the counterfeiters like a ton of bricks. Here's Tony Weber again from the FCAI.
They actually went through the process of tracking down where the facility that made these parts was located. And the good news for consumers is that that facility was raided by the Chinese authorities and the counterfeit parts were seized. So I think this is probably the way of the future. And I think that's a wonderful sign that the Chinese authorities, who ultimately raided this facility in China, they are working internationally with other companies and governments to stop counterfeit parts.
Tim Roxburgh bringing a bit more nuance to the story of counterfeit goods and China. That's it for this week. You can find out more at The Money's homepage, abc.net.au/rn. The show's produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer today is Andre Shabanov. I'm Richard Adie.